ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day there. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 11th of March. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The government's proposed vehicle efficiency standards could face changes, with Labor saying it'll consider sensible ideas from the car industry on how to implement it. The proposal to slash vehicle emissions by 60% by 2030 is expected to see more efficient vehicles enter the market, including electric vehicles, but the opposition's labelling it a family car and ute tax. Sales for EVs are already strong and not in the areas you might think. New data out today shows the fastest growing demand is in outer metropolitan areas. As climate reporter Joe Lauder reports, there are a number of factors that are driving the trend, especially high petrol prices.
I'm doing easily 100k round trip for just our shift, and sometimes it goes up to 200k's. So over a week, I can easily do 700k's.
Nandan Aluri lives on the Mornington Peninsula, southeast of Melbourne. Since he started leasing his electric car a year ago, he's driven a massive 37,000 kilometres. He's a numbers guy and has worked out that he's already saved thousands of dollars on running costs.
I'm basically saving between petrol and servicing $5,500 to $6,000 a year. For 100 kilometres, it was $10 to $15 for a petrol car. For the electric vehicle, it's about $1.20 for 100Ks.
Nanda only charges his car at home in his driveway, and he's got solar on the roof.
I can do my entire work commute for like $5 to $10 a week or something like that. It's something ridiculously cheap.
According to new EV sales data, more and more outer suburban drivers like Nanda are making the switch to electric.
Growth has for the last few years been occurring in the outer suburbs of our major cities as well as in regional areas.
Bayar Jafari is the CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council, which provided this data to the ABC. It covers 2023 sales for Australia's two biggest electric car makers, Tesla and BYD, which the council says makes up around three quarters of the market. 43% of new EVs sold by the two car makers last year were for people in outer metropolitan areas.
It's really important piece of information, really dispelling this idea that it's now quite a few years out of date that people buying electric vehicles are sort of wealthy residents of the inner cities. In fact, when we ask people today why they bought an electric vehicle, certainly they're excited for the new technology. But the number one reason they give back is being able to avoid high fuel bills.
The postcode with the most EV purchases last year was Rouse Hill and Kellyville in Sydney's northwest, 43 kilometres from the CBD. 531 EVs were sold to residents in those suburbs last year.
Yeah, we heard this directly from Tesla last year that their Parramatta delivery centre was their busiest centre in the entire country.
In Victoria, the outer suburb of Werribee between Geelong and Melbourne came top in the state with 429 new EVs. Hussein Dia is a professor of future urban mobility at Swinburne University and says the price of petrol is one of the main reasons people switch to electric, despite the more expensive price tag.
People in outer suburbs usually tend to travel more. Public transport is not as convenient, and the more they travel, the petrol bill is going to be higher.
Intercity drivers aren't far behind, making up 39% of new EV sales, and 18% were people from regional and rural Australia. Professor Dia thinks access to at-home charging and rooftop solar are also encouraging more people to switch to EVs.
I think people in inner suburbs might hesitate or might say, you know, where am I going to charge it? I live in an apartment. But most probably people in the outer suburbs, that they have either a townhouse or a house.
The federal government is in the process of introducing a fuel efficiency standard, which it says will encourage car makers to start selling more electric cars in Australia. Almost 10% of new cars sold in Australia last month were electric.
Joe Lauder there. Tourism operators are concerned about the future of one of our greatest natural wonders. Warmer waters have pushed the Great Barrier Reef into yet another period of mass coral bleaching, the fifth such event in just 8 years. Annie Guest reports.
Confirmation that the Great Barrier Reef is in the grip of another mass coral bleaching event saddened but didn't completely surprise Anne Hoggett. The co-director of the Australian Museum's Lizard Island Research Station had already seen signs of it.
This event is the worst one that we've seen since 2016, which was the big one on the Great Barrier Reef. But most of the corals around Lizard Island itself are either fluorescing, which is they're brightly coloured under stress, or they're bright white, and some of them have even started to die.
Vibrant coral colours are created by the algae that covers it, and when coral is too hot, it expels the algae, causing bleaching. Aerial surveys over two-thirds of the reef have shown most corals in shallow water have bleaching. The Marine Park Authority notes that it is variable and recovery can be possible. Anne Hoggett agrees.
They can recover, but they have gone further this time than we have ever seen them gone before and recover. So we don't know if they're still capable of recovering or not.
Since 1998, the 2,000-kilometre-long natural wonder has had seven widespread mass bleachings, and they're becoming more frequent, with five in the last 8 years. Anne Hoggett acknowledges work on pests and water quality, but says there's only one solution.
But really, you might as well not do those things if we don't control the temperature of the water. We've just got to get much, much more serious about controlling our carbon emission. You know, we've got to stop, you know, allowing new mines to open up.
If not, then what is, or what do you fear could be the future for the Great Barrier Reef?
I fear that these incidents that are happening are just going to happen much too frequently for the reef to be able to recover.
The Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, declined AM's interview request, but earlier released a statement on social media saying the federal and Queensland governments are investing more than $4.7 billion in the reef between 2014 and 2030.
Dealing with feral species and invasives like crown of thorn starfish, improving water quality on the reef. We've legislated a pathway to net zero by 2050.
But Whitsunday tourism industry veteran Tony Fonts isn't reassured after diving on the reef for 40 years. He questions the future of the Great Barrier Reef.
We're running out of time. We have probably exceeded 1.5 degrees in global warming, and that, as we continue up towards 2.0, could be the death knell to a coral reefs around the world.
That's Whitsunday tourism industry veteran Tony Fonts, our reporter Annie Guest. The Prime Minister continues to rule out an early election, maybe at the end of this year, but the softening up campaign to ease the high cost of living continues. This morning, it's about reducing a range of tariffs on imports that should eventually see lower costs passed on to consumers. For more, I spoke earlier with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, some of these tariffs are on items we mightn't necessarily think about when it comes to trimming cost of living pressures.
Yes, well, David, Treasurer Jim Chalmers describes these as nuisance taxes that will be abolished from the 1st of July this year. 500 small tariffs that create red tape for businesses who have to spend a lot of time and money on compliance. Things like washing machines, imports worth $490 million, but only $140,000 in tax revenue. Toothbrushes, imports of $84 million, only $22,000 of revenue. Dodgem cars, $2 million of imports, but only $15,000 of revenue. Menstrual and sanitary products, we import $211 million in value per year, but that only raises $3 million. Then you have things like chopsticks, fishing reels, ballpoint pens, toasters, x-ray film, electric blankets, all nuisance imports, but the revenue isn't worth the trouble of collecting it.
Right, so we're not getting a whole lot of tariffs or tax revenue from these imports. Will these tariff reductions actually make a difference to households doing it tough?
Well, it might not sound like a lot in dollar terms, but this is the biggest reform of the tariff system in 20 years, 14% of tariffs overall, and they're designed to save businesses around $30 million in compliance costs. Now, we constantly hear about productivity from the Treasurer and the Reserve Bank, which are critical to reforming the economy, but these tariff reforms will go some small way to helping with that if businesses spend less time with red tape and consumers end up benefiting.
Okay, we're about 2 months out from the May budget now. Does it feel like this announcement's just the start of the softening up?
Yes, just the start. Expect more announcements like this one that are carefully managed, not as cash handouts, but small measures on cost of living relief. Jim Chalmers being careful not to do anything that might stoke inflation if more money's pumped into the economy. Given that inflation inflation is slowing, but it's still well above the RBA's 2 to 3% target band. The tariff reforms will be open for consultation until April the 1st, with the full tariff reforms to be outlined in the May budget. So more money into the pockets of average workers already, with changes to stage three tax cuts and earlier changes in superannuation for large balances for the wealthy. But so far, no sign of major, brave, broad-based tax reform that economists and businesses are crying out for.
That's our senior business and Dodgem Car correspondent Peter Ryan. To Gaza, and the Muslim religious month of Ramadan is now underway. It was also an Israeli deadline to get hostages released from the war-torn enclave. Israel had threatened to invade Rafah in southern Gaza if the hostages were not freed. Gazans are waiting now to see what will happen while the US is carrying out aid drops and preparing to build a pier to deliver aid by sea. Nicole Johnston has more.
Parachutes drop boxes of aid across Gaza onto hungry crowds below. But it's an imperfect way to deliver it. Five people were killed by the airdrops over the weekend when a number of parachutes failed to open. The US, Jordan, France, Bahrain and Qatar are scrambling to get aid in. But it's not enough. Speaking to an American network, US President Joe Biden warned Israel this war is damaging its standing in the eyes of the world.
He has a right to defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world, it's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake. So I want to see a ceasefire. And I'm starting with a major, major exchange of prisoners for a six-week period. We're going into Ramadan. It should be nothing happening. And we should build off of that ceasefire.
But there is no ceasefire yet, no exchange of prisoners or release of Israeli hostages. Negotiations between Israel and Hamas appear stuck. The Muslim month of fasting from daylight to dusk has started. It's normally a time of celebration, but this year it is wretched. No Ramadan spirit, no last-minute shopping. There's barely any food in the Gaza Strip left to buy. In Rafah, this is Hamis Al-Kanani.
I think this Ramadan will add to the tragedies of the Palestinian people and a new torment. And any person who says that they can endure the pain of this month, financially, spiritually, mentally, look at this market. There is nothing to buy.
Fear and famine is stalking Gaza. The UN says more than 500,000 people are at risk of starvation. Sufyan Al-Yazji says his children are suffering.
There's nothing, no dates or milk or anything for the children. These canned goods are full of germs that infect the stomach. The children are weak and dying from hunger.
The US is sending a ship to Gaza to start building a pier to deliver more aid. Another ship is waiting in Cyprus for the green light to deliver supplies by sea. Gaza journalist Safwat Abu Omar says he's had enough.
On the ground, things are even much worse, many times much, much worse than what you see on TV. Gaza is not Gaza anymore. The top priority now is just to leave Gaza. Once you are outside Gaza, at least you guarantee that you will not be hit by a rocket.
That's Gaza journalist Safwat Abu Omar, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. Well, as world leaders push for a ceasefire in Gaza, inside Israel, there's a strong determination to continue the war, with one senior minister saying Hamas has dug the biggest cemetery in the world. The ABC's global affairs editor, John Lyons, has interviewed leading members of Israel's political and intelligence establishment who say they're preparing for a war that could last 2 years.
This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined.
While President Joe Biden is now joining other world leaders in calling for a ceasefire to try to bring an end to the five-month war, inside Israel, the sentiment is very different. The Israeli public is still strongly behind the war, which Israel launched in response to Hamas's atrocities on October 7. Avi Dichter is a member of the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and a former head of Shin Bet, Israel's intelligence agency.
How long do you think Israel's war against Hamas will last?
How long it will take? It may take a year or two.
While Israelis still support the war, there's growing concern about the influence on the Netanyahu government of the far right, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Minister for National Security, and Bezalel Smotrich, the Minister for Finance. Ami Ayalon is also a former head of Shin Bet.
I see them as terrorists and as Jewish messianics. They represent only a small minority within the Israeli society, but they get their power because of our coalition system.
But can I just check something? Are you calling the Minister for National Security and the Minister for Finance in Israel, are you calling them terrorists?
Of course, they are.
Support for Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party has plummeted since the start of the war, and public trust in the Prime Minister is low. That's a feeling Israel's former Foreign Minister Zippy Livni shares.
Do you trust Benjamin Netanyahu?
Never.
Can there be peace while Benjamin Netanyahu is the leader here?
No.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, the country's most decorated soldier, is just as blunt when asked his assessment of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
I don't think that anyone can trust him. Basically, he lies to everyone and no one trusts him.
That's former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. After decades fighting costly battles over cultural fishing rights in local courts, native title holders on the New South Wales south coast are now taking their legal battle to a new front. Today, they will file a class action in the federal court, which could see over 10,000 people eligible for compensation from the New South Wales government for the continuing prosecution of traditional fishing practices. Vanessa Milton reports.
Steve Clark, a Bidjigal Wadi Wadi Wandian man from Nowra, south of Sydney, was taught to dive for abalone and lobster as a child. But by the time he reached his teens, he started to be pursued by fisheries compliance officers and prosecuted.
From then on, I was pretty much targeted. Every time I went to the beach or rocks or anywhere, I'd be there.
The 53-year-old gave up diving in his late 20s, after being fined thousands of dollars and serving jail time over unpaid fishing fines, and he stopped teaching his kids to dive.
I would have liked to continue to carry on those skills and teachings, but it takes away my identity as a strong Aboriginal man.
For the Yuin people on the New South Wales south coast, the tradition of gathering abalone and other seafood dates back millennia. And for the past 30 years, their fishing rights have been protected by native title law. But Aboriginal divers continue to be prosecuted for exceeding state government bag limits. Now the community is taking the fight to the federal court, filing a class action against the New South Wales government. They claim the state government's failure to recognise the native title rights of Aboriginal fishers is in breach of the Racial Discrimination Act, and has had a devastating impact on health, family cohesion, and the handing down of saltwater cultural practices across generations.
We believe that people deserve to be compensated and acknowledged for the wrongs of the past. A lot of people have expressed to us that these kind of prosecutions are having a real chilling effect on the practice of cultural fishing on the south coast.
That's Solicitor Tristan Gavin, who is acting for the claim group, which includes over 10,000 Aboriginal people on the New South Wales south coast. He has been involved in stolen wages and stolen generations class actions that have won hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation for Aboriginal communities. This legal action comes after a series of cases brought by the New South Wales government against Aboriginal fishers have been dismissed or withdrawn in local courts. Solicitor Catherine Ridge has successfully defended 14 South Coast native title holders facing prosecution over fishing matters. She believes the local courts are not the right place to test native title holders' rights.
The problem is at a much higher level, and I think the class action is better placed to deal with that injustice.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the New South Wales Minister for Agriculture said that these matters are complex socially and legally, and the New South Wales government is working its way through them to ensure any regulation and enforcement balances the needs of fish conservation, cultural sensitivities, and community needs.
Vanessa Milton, our reporter there. That's AM for today. Thank you so much for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 5 months since the war in Gaza began, the death toll has climbed above 30,000, according to Gaza health authorities, with about a third of them children. Today, Global Affairs editor John Lyons takes us to the Middle East as part of a special Four Corners investigation into Israel's approach to the war and the role its ally, the United States, is playing. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.